suits well with diamonds. However, she has been no more forthcoming than that. Joyce is wearing another new cardigan, navy blue. It had better be worth it. "What are we going to do about Ryan Baird?" asked Elizabeth. "You tell me," says Joyce. "You always have the answers." "Are we having a row, Joyce?" asked Elizabeth. "How novel." "Friends don't keep secrets," says Joyce. "It's a good secret, though, so don't get crotchety," says Elizabeth. "I just want to surprise you." The minibus pulls up outside the Rymans in Fairhaven, and Carlito bids them all farewell. He is vaping, and Elizabeth tells him to smoke a proper cigarette, for goodness sake. "So where are we going?" asks Joyce. "You know where we're going," says Elizabeth, and sets off towards the seafront. "You're so infuriating," says Joyce, setting off behind her. "I know," says Elizabeth. "I honestly can't help it. I have tried." The shops peter out and they find themselves on a familiar route. They pass the rows and rows of lock-up garages. They pass Le Pont Noir. Elizabeth striding, Joyce hurrying to keep up. "Are we going back to the train station?" asked Joyce. "By George, I think she's got it," says Elizabeth. "Why are we going to the station?" But Elizabeth is hurrying ahead. The walk continues until they find themselves inside Fairhaven train station. No need to follow the signs this time. They stop at the left luggage office and the receptionist takes off her headphones and smiles. "Welcome back." "Thank you," says Elizabeth. "Do you need anything?" "No, thank you, dear," says Elizabeth, and holds up the key to locker 531. Elizabeth and Joyce enter the rows of lockers and Elizabeth stops by the first one. She takes something out of her handbag and passes it to Joyce. It is the locket that Douglas gave her. "You found something in the locket?" asks Joyce. "Is that why we're back here?" Elizabeth holds up a finger to stop her. "Joyce, you solved this for me."
"Oh, good," says Joyce.
"Well, you and Bogdan."
"I don't mind sharing with Bogdan," says Joyce.
"You worked out that Poppy overheard my conversation with Douglas, which made me really think about the conversation. I've told you there's never a word out of place with Douglas. He is meticulous. Even in our wedding vows, I noticed he put the slightest question mark after I do."
"Oh," says Joyce.
"When we were by the tree, he reminded me of a dead letter drop we had in East Berlin. Only, you see, the dead letter drop was in West Berlin. I put it down to old age. It hits men harder, as we know."
"But it wasn't old age."
"Open the locket and what do you see?" Joyce opens the locket.
"Nothing, just the mirror."
"Just the mirror, precisely. The worthless mirror that Douglas was so keen to give to me. But what does a mirror do? It turns East Berlin into West Berlin. It turns Nike into Ekin. And," Elizabeth holds up the key, Joyce almost squeals.
"It turns 531 into 135.
Elizabeth nods and motions along the line of lockers.
"Would you like to do the honours?"
Joyce follows behind her.
"No, you."
They reach locker 135 and Elizabeth slides the key into the lock. It's a perfect fit. She turns it and the door swings open. Inside is a blue velvet bag with a drawstring around the top. Elizabeth motions for Joyce to take it.
Joyce lifts the bag and loosens the drawstring. Diamonds sparkle inside. 30 or so, big ones. She was wearing exactly the right cardigan. "You're holding £20 million, Joyce," says Elizabeth. "Slip it into your bag, will you? And promise not to get mugged on the way back to the minibus." Elizabeth reaches into the locker again and pulls out a note. It is from Douglas. She reads it, then shows it to Joyce. "Darling Elizabeth, so you found them. Sorry for the wild goose chase, but it was fun, no? Did you get it from East Berlin, or did you need the mirror? Belt and braces, I know. I didn't want to make it too easy, but I wanted to make sure you would get there eventually. I hope you didn't go down to the cottage in Rye. They built a bypass through it years ago. In any event, congratulations. Aren't they beautiful? What will you do with them? You really should keep them. Go on. You know you want to." On a slightly more somber note, it goes without saying that if you found this note, then I am dead. So it is swings and roundabouts, isn't it? Though life is always swings and roundabouts, so I don't see why death should be any different. I wonder if I'll be heading upstairs. I doubt it, don't you? I will love you always. Douglas. Joyce hands the letter back to Elizabeth. Elizabeth folds it up and returns it to the locker. Joyce looks down into her bag at the diamonds. They are tucked away under a Kate Atkinson. "So what are we going to do with the diamonds?" she asks. "I don't suppose we could just keep them." Elizabeth slips her arm through the arm of her friend. "We're going to use them as bait to catch Poppy and Siobhan." Joyce nods. "It will be nice to see Poppy again, even if she murdered Douglas. And maybe bait for a few more people who deserve catching too," says Elizabeth. "Perhaps we could just keep one or two of the diamonds," says Joyce. "I don't think anyone would notice." "I think," says Elizabeth, "that we need to convene an emergency meeting of the Thursday Murder Club." "Wonderful," says Joyce. "I'm sorry I was angry earlier." "Don't mention it," says Elizabeth. "I'm infuriating." Joyce smiles. "You certainly are. Would you like a flapjack?" "Finally," says Elizabeth. Chapter 68. Donna is drinking whiskey on Chris's sofa. They have just been watching Succession, her favourite show. Billions of pounds, family rows, people in and out of helicopters every 5 minutes. She could handle a bit of that. Chris has never seen it because he is nearly 52 and never watches anything new unless he is forced to. She knows he would happily watch repeats of The In-Betweeners and Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares until the day he dies. Chris is currently on FaceTime with her mum. "Wish you were here, Patsy," he is saying. "Patsy, Christ. Also, wish you were here. My company not up to scratch?" Patrice replies, "I'm coming down on Sunday, Big Bear." Donna can't help but smile. Let them enjoy themselves. The chat with Ibrahim has done her good. Life was not running away from her, just the opposite. She was running away from life. So, onwards and upwards, all that nonsense. There is a ring on her mum's doorbell and she says, "Hold on, gorgeous, let me get that." "Leave it," says Chris quickly. Donna looks up. That doesn't sound like him. But Patrice ignores him, of course. It runs in the family. "Leave it?" asks Donna. Chris dismisses her with his hand. "I was just enjoying chatting." His eyes flick back to the screen. Patrice is still not there. Donna tilts her head. "Is something up?" "Stop being such a police officer, Donna," says Chris. "What a mentor you are," says Donna. "Every day I'm learning." Patrice is still not back. Chris starts to whistle, but his leg is jiggling up and down at speed. Something isn't adding up here. "So, did you enjoy Succession?" Donna asks. "Yep, yep," says Chris, but his eyes don't leave the empty screen. The top of a sofa, a dying pot plant, and an old school photo of Donna with a missing front tooth. "You're looking at an empty screen instead of me." "Sorry," says Chris, and gives Donna the briefest of glances before looking back at his computer. What was going on here? Perhaps he's in love. He'd better be. "You're not hiding anything." Donna is interrupted by the return of Patrice. "Sorry, dear, it was the Lib Dems at the door. I had to put them straight on tuition fees." Chris's leg has stopped jiggling, and he has sucked his stomach in again. Donna's phone buzzes, a message from Elizabeth. "You are cordially invited to a meeting of the Thursday Murder Club, tomorrow at 11 in the Jigsaw Room. I recommend attendance." Chapter 69. Chris could live without this. Two spies had been shot. Or one spy had been shot by another spy. Or no spies had been shot and the whole thing was one big magic trick. But whatever the truth of it, it wasn't something he could get involved with. He could catch and handcuff the killer himself, but no one would ever get to hear about it. This was one for the security services. It was interesting, sure, murder and diamonds, and if he was in a better place, he could enjoy it. But all he can think about is Connie Johnson. Connie Johnson and Patrice. When Patrice's doorbell rang last night, he had feared the worst and had hid it badly from Donna. Perhaps Ron and Bogdan could work a miracle? But here he is regardless, out of politeness, in the Jigsaw Room with the Thursday Murder Club in full flow. Dominating the room are three huge boards, each covered in a sheet of perspex. Beneath the perspex sit half-finished jigsaws of the Heywayne, Sydney Opera House at sunset, and a 2,000-piece puzzle of the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana. So far, only the borders of that jigsaw and the eyes of the happy couple have been completed. During the opening pleasantries, Chris had been looking into Diana's eyes. The future was there for all to see. "Poor Diana," he thought. "I hope you had a bit of fun along the way." But now Elizabeth has dropped the bombshell and she has Chris's full attention. "So you have £20 million worth of diamonds?" asks Chris Hudson. "In your possession?" "Yes, give or take," says Elizabeth. "And where are they?" asks Donna. "Never you mind where they are," says Elizabeth. "They're in my kettle," says Joyce. "Do your spy friends know you've got them?" asks Chris. "Not yet," says Elizabeth. "I'll tell them, but I need a plan in place first. I thought you could help." "If we help, can I see the diamonds?" asks Donna. "Of course, dear, I'm not a monster," says Elizabeth. "What can Donna and me do?" asks Chris. "Donna and I," says Elizabeth. "If I tell you, you have to promise not to get angry." "Oh, here we go again," says Chris.
I want to organise a meeting with the Mafia in Fairhaven.
Of course you do, says Chris.
Any reason? Or was Bridge cancelled and you had a slot in your diary? You know I don't like humour, Chris, says Elizabeth.
We want to drag Poppy out of hiding, says Joyce. Get her to break cover.
She'll still be looking for the diamonds, says Elizabeth. So she'll be keeping track of me somehow, or she'll be keeping track of Sue Reardon or Martin Lomax. So I want us all together in the same place with the diamonds Monday afternoon, say 3-ish.
I don't understand what you need from Donna and I, says Chris.
From Donna and me this time, says Elizabeth. I need you outside, keeping those keen eyes peeled for Poppy.
None of this is my business, Elizabeth, says Chris.
I can't just suddenly get involved. Donna, back me up, is not our case.
Donna agrees. The killings are not our case. Martin Lomax isn't our case. The Mafia's not our case, unfortunately. I'd love it if the Mafia was my case.
And even if we were there, says Chris, what's your plan while we're waiting outside? Give a load of diamonds to the Mafia?
I haven't worked out that bit of my plan yet, says Elizabeth, but I will.
You can be sure she will, says Ibrahim.
Sorry, says Chris. I've done all sorts for you, and I've always wondered where I'd draw the line, and I think that line might be keeping watch as you hand over £20 million to the largest crime syndicate in the world.
They are at an impasse, until Ron clears his throat.
I've got a suggestion. A good one, if anyone's interested.
Ron, I love you dearly, says Elizabeth. But are you sure it's a good one?
I was just thinking, says Ron. Seeing as it's not Chris's case, why don't we make it Chris's case?
This does actually sound like it might be good, says Joyce to Elizabeth.
Chris, says Ron. You and Donna have been chasing that drug dealer, haven't you? The woman.
Connie Johnson, says Donna.
Is that the one? Yeah, I don't know nothing about her, says Ron, but it's your case, right?
It is, says Chris.
Well, what about we get her involved? We tell her we're some big gang down from London. Tell her we've got a diamond trade set up with the Mafia. We've got a meeting locally and we've heard good things. Does she fancy getting involved?
Chris could kiss Ron. He won't, but he could.
So Sue and Lance and that mob can swoop and catch Lomax and the Mafia geezer, and you and Donna can catch the woman. Remind me of her name again?
Connie Johnson, Ron, says Chris.
Actually, he will kiss him. First chance he gets.
If you say so, says Ron.
What do you reckon?
Chris looks at Donna.
If we got a tip-off that Connie Johnson was doing a deal and we had a time and a place, we'd go and investigate, wouldn't we?
We'd pay it a visit, I reckon, says Donna.
Ron, says Elizabeth, this isn't bad at all. But how do we convince Connie Johnson that we're a big London gang?
Ron motions to himself, offended.
I just show up, don't I? Whack on a suit, tell him I'm Billy Baxter or Jimmy Jackson down from Camden, flash the tattoos, flash the diamonds.
Hmm, says Elizabeth.
I'm not sure that gangsters have Chairman Mao tattoos, says Joyce.
All right, I'll take Bogdan with me, says Ron.
Well, this is beginning to feel like a plan, says Elizabeth.
We'll go and pick up Frank Andrade from Farnborough Airport on Monday morning, tell him the good news, we have the diamonds, do come with us. We'll get Lance to bring Lomax down with him, get them all over here to meet Connie Johnson. We'll have Sue listening in a truck and, no doubt, Poppy loitering nearby. Everybody gets arrested, everybody gets medals, and we're home in time for eggheads.
Where should we have the meeting?
I need somewhere we can control, somewhere without escape routes. Donna pipes up. There's a manager's office above the arcade at the end of the pier. I had to visit it once because of all the underage kids on the machines. The manager tried to bribe me with a grand in Tempe's.
The end of the pier sounds perfect, says Elizabeth. Oh, and Ibrahim, I'm going to need you to drive us up to Farnborough and back.
Not on Monday, says Ibrahim, shaking his head. My ribs and my eyesight. Maybe in a few weeks. I would love to, but I'm afraid I can't.
Donna looks at Ibrahim. I think you probably can, though. Don't you? Just a little mountain.
Ibrahim thinks, then shakes his head at her and mouths, sorry. Chris looks at Donna. What was that about?
Splendid, says Elizabeth. Everyone has a job to do.
Except Joyce, says Ibrahim. Joyce smiles.
Oh, I have a job to do. A secret for now, though.
Ron, do you fancy walking me over to mine afterwards? I have an idea for you. And Donna, why don't you wander over with us too? And I can show you the diamonds before you head off.
Chapter 70. Joyce. I didn't want to say I had found Ryan Baird in front of everyone, least of all Ibrahim, who doesn't even know he's missing. I had the file that Poppy had given us, all of Ryan Baird's information, big photo and lots of details, and I had been looking through it, trying to find a bit of inspiration. Can I say, by the way, that Poppy had put a post-it note on the front of the file and had put a little kiss and a smiley face on that post-it note? And I just wonder if that's really the sort of thing a murderer would do. Perhaps cold-blooded murderers are endlessly drawing smiley faces on post-it notes. I was going to say I don't really know any murderers, but of course I do these days. I know we can all pretend to be all sorts of things. Jerry once pretended to be Dutch when we were camping in the Dordogne. He did the accent and everything. That was just for a bit of fun to make me laugh. He wasn't planning on shooting anyone. I think it's a fact that Poppy must have found the letter in the tree. Nothing else makes sense otherwise. And I know it's a fact that Poppy's mum opened locker 531 and that the next day someone shot someone in the safe house on St. Albans Avenue. So all fingers point to Poppy. But still I come back to the smiley face and the little kiss on the post-it note. So yes, the file. I had looked up Ryan Baird on Instagram before, of course. There were 12 of them, but only one in Kent. Big Baird Wolf 2003. But the account was private, and I am not a computer hacker, and I don't know any computer hackers, so I didn't take it any further. Someone from BT came round to fix my broadband last week, and I asked her if she knew how to hack into private Instagram accounts, but she didn't. I still don't know how to get into my @greatjoy69 private messages. There are now over 1,000. How frustrating. Anyway, then I had a bright idea, even if I say so myself. In Poppy's file is a list of Ryan Baird's friends and family members, and so I started looking them up on Instagram too. I thought, well, he's gone somewhere, hasn't he? If I was ever on the run, there's a woman I used to work with, Sandra Nugent, who retired to the Isle of Wight, and I would probably go and stay with her. She says it's the middle of nowhere, but you can still get a Tesco delivery, so that would suit me down to the ground. Sandra can get a bit much sometimes, but if you're on the run, you can't be too picky. Ryan Baird's mum is in Littlehampton, but I couldn't find her on Instagram. I couldn't even find her on Facebook, so she may very well be dead.
He has an older sister, Leanne, and I think I found her, but she never posts anything except rainbows in support of various different things. Good for her, but no help to me. Then we got on to cousins, of which there were plenty. This was a long job, by the way. I'm making it sound quick, but it wasn't. There were so many people to check, and I also kept getting distracted by new posts from people I follow. I watched Joe Wicks do a new workout, for example. The file got on to Stephen Baird, born in Paisley, which I know is in Scotland. So I had a little search, and there are lots of Bairds in Scotland, and lots of Stephens too. So I scrolled through a few. Then I stumbled across Stevie Blunter Rangers Forever. He had a look of Ryan Baird about him, something unfortunate around the eyes, so I thought I would explore a little. It didn't take long. 2 days ago, Stevie Blunter had posted a series of pictures of a party. It was in a small, messy flat, and even in the photographs it looked loud. Then I found the photograph I was looking for. The caption read, "Blunting of Manat, wim Makaz Pablo." I couldn't really make head nor tail of it, but the photo showed Stephen Baird arms around Ryan Baird, both smoking roll-up cigarettes, clear as day. So there he is, in Scotland. After the Thursday Murder Club meeting, I asked Donna and Ron to come over. First things first, I showed Donna the diamonds. She held the biggest one on her ring finger and walked up and down like a model. Then she made Ron do the same, and they were both laughing. I took the opportunity of an empty kettle to make us all a cup of tea. I showed them both the photo, and they both said I'd done a wonderful job. Ron hugged me. I will say this for Ron, he is not my type, but he is a very good hugger. He will make a very specific type of woman a very good husband one day. It is a shame about Siobhan, because she might even have been that woman. I wonder who she actually is. Donna translated the Instagram caption for me. It means smoking cannabis with my cousin Pablo. Pablo must be Ryan Baird's nickname. Donna said she would get straight on to Strathclyde police and have him tracked down and arrested. But then I told her my plan instead. She and Ron both listened and then agreed that my plan was much more fun. They've just gone, the two of them, and the diamonds are back in the kettle where they belong. Ron is off to see Connie Johnson tomorrow. I'd like to be a fly on the wall, I really would. You can see he feels 10 feet tall at the moment, and I have every faith in him. I can see the post-it note in front of me still. Poppy's smiley face. I don't know at all, I really don't. Perhaps she'll turn up on Fairhaven Pier on Monday, or perhaps she really is dead, and this is a wild goose chase. But I suspect that Elizabeth is right in one thing. If we get everybody together at the end of the pier, diamonds out in the open, then surely we'll find out exactly who shot who and why. Chapter 71. Connie Johnson has changed 3 times already this morning. The summer dress was too obvious, the jumpsuit was not obvious enough, and the trousers she'd bought from Whistles were perfect. But she hadn't been able to comfortably hide her gun in them. In the end, she had a brainwave, and she is dressed in her Lycra gym kit. This sent a number of messages. Firstly, "Oh, this meeting is not a big deal. I'm just fitting it in on the way to the gym." But more importantly, "Here you go, Bogdan. This is what's on offer," but in a healthy rather than a slutty way. And her gun is in a handy bum bag. There is a large bag of MDMA on her desk, which she tidies into a drawer before checking her watch. They are due any minute. Bogdan had slipped a letter under the lock-up door. A letter? Swoon. He was bringing a man called Vic Vincent with him to discuss some sort of deal. Vincent being some major player in London. She had Googled Vic Vincent, of course, and nothing had come up, which was all the reassurance she needed. She was dealing with a pro. There is a baseball bat covered with barbed wire leaning up against the photocopier, and Connie nudges it out of sight. She checks her hair once again. Perhaps Bogdan will be wearing a singlet. Those glorious arms rippling, ready to... There is a loud bang on the metal door. Here we go, Connie. As she gets to the door, she notices a large blood stain under one of the coat hooks. Too late to clean it up now, they'll just have to take her as they find her. She opens the door and in walk Bogdan and Vic Vincent. They shake hands. Bogdan is not wearing a singlet, but he is wearing sunglasses, so she still has plenty to work with. Vic Vincent looks familiar, but she can't place him. Have their paths crossed before? He looks the part, face admirably busted, but his suit is a little too tight. And is that a West Ham United tie? Nobody wants coffee. You mustn't drink coffee before the gym, Bogdan says, and yes, of course, she should have thought of that. They sit. I've heard good things about you, Connie, says Vic Vincent. From Bogdan here. He's heard good things from Bogdan. Bogdan has been talking about her. I see. And does Bogdan work for you? Vic Vincent laughs. Bogdan don't work for no one, but now and again I ask him to help out. He gets a job done with no fuss, you understand? I understand, says Connie. She looks over at Bogdan, sitting there silent in his sunglasses like Mr. Darcy. She just bets he gets a job done with no fuss. I've got something you might be able to help me with. You interested in diamonds? Asks Vic Vincent. Where does she know him from? Not really, says Connie. I'm interested in money, though, if that's involved too. Vic Vincent nods. Bogdan is looking around the room. She is glad she tidied away the bag of MDMA and the baseball bat. You can tell he likes tidy. You ever dealt with the Mafia? Asks Vic. The Mafia? Well, this is getting interesting. Connie shakes her head. I tried to cancel Sky Sports once. That's the closest I've got. A gentleman is coming down to Fairhaven on Monday. He's called Frank Andrade. I want someone to meet him. We've got a room on the end of the pier, manager's office. Connie nods. She knows the room well. She once threatened to burn down the arcade. Perhaps Bogdan will be at the meeting. What will she wear then? The Mafia and Bogdan. I need someone I can trust, and Bogdan says that's you. To give Mr. Andrade these. Vic Vincent hands her a blue velvet bag. She opens the drawstring. Diamonds. He wasn't kidding. What are they worth? Connie asks. Let's just say they're worth doing the job properly, says Vic Vincent. The buttons on his shirt are straining. That face is so familiar. What's going on here? And why can't you hand them over yourself? We don't get on. I killed his brother. Connie nods. Been there. And why at the end of a pier? A lot of people want these diamonds. I can't tell you why, but they do. We need somewhere we can keep an eye on everyone who's coming or going. And what's in it for me? Asks Connie. There'll be another geezer there called Lomax. Andrade trusts him. Sells a lot of coke in South London and looking for a new wholesaler. What happened to his old wholesaler? Accident with a cement mixer, says Vic. Clumsy, says Connie. So, I told him to check you out. Buy 50 grand's worth from you, check the quality, see if you might be what he's looking for.
Connie nods.
And for that introduction, you hand over the diamonds to Andrade for me. Sound fair?
Vic Vincent gives her a little smile.
Connie knows this guy, she swears, knows his face. Talk about too good to be true.
Is this the copper Chris Hudson setting her up?
Connie fiddles with her bum bag for a moment and then pulls out her gun. She points it straight at Vic Vincent, if that was really his name. Vic and Bogdan both raise their eyebrows a little.
Sorry, mate, no offence, but I know you. I've seen you before.
Connie keeps the gun pointing straight between Vic Vincent's eyes. Vic scratches a tattoo on his arm. It says, Kendrick. Without taking her eyes off him, she addresses Bogdan.
Who is he, Bogdan? Just tell me. Just tell me. And you boys can walk out and we'll say no more about it.
Can she kill Vic Vincent and still go for a drink with Bogdan?
She doubts it, but she'll have a good go.
He's Vic Vincent, says Bogdan. I worked for him a few times, never any trouble.
Keep going, says Connie.
Vic Vincent looks cool as you like, but a bead of sweat drops down his neck across a faded West Ham tattoo.
He called me a few weeks ago, says, Bogdan, you know anyone I can trust? I said, Connie, because I trust you.
God, this is hard, thinks Connie, but focus.
He asks if you deal coke, and I say, of course, everybody does. So he tells me, buy coke from her, let me see.
That 10 grand the other day, asks Connie.
That was Vic's money.
Connie starts to laugh. She puts down the gun and gives Vic Vincent a hug. He is sweatier than she expects.
That's where I know your face from. I've got someone who follows everyone when they leave here.
Checks they're not cops, rivals, whatever, takes photos. Bogdan took the coke to you by the pier.
Connie opens a drawer and flicks through some photos. She pulls out one of Ron and Bogdan by Fairhaven Pier.
Dressed as a plumber, I like it. I knew your face. Sorry, Mr. Vincent, I didn't mean to point a gun at you.
No problem, says Vic Vincent and scratches his Kendrick tattoo again. And bring that gun with you on Monday, just in case.
So I'm in, says Connie. 50 grand of coke and the diamonds.
Monday, 3 p.m., says Vic Vincent.
Connie looks at Bogdan.
And will you be there?
Bogdan takes off his sunglasses and looks straight at her.
Yes. We can do it together.
Jesus Christ, that was an intense look.
Maybe we could all go for a drink.
You are going to the gym, says Bogdan, putting his sunglasses back on.
Damn!
I need one more favour, Connie, says Vic Vincent. If you don't mind, nothing difficult.
Go on, says Connie.
My wife's niece lives down here and she's got a boy looking for an opportunity, just thinking you might need a driver on the day. Wondered if you'd give him a chance.
I've got a driver, says Connie.
I'd rather have someone I know I could trust too, says Vic Vincent. Family. He's done a bit of work for you before, the way he tells it. He can drive the three of us to dinner afterwards, if you fancy.
Connie does fancy.
Sure. What's his name?
Ryan Baird, says Vic Vincent, and slips a piece of paper over to Connie.
He's up in Scotland at the moment, that's the address.
You think you could send someone up to bring him down for Monday?
Of course, nods Connie, thinking about where to go for dinner.
Monday on the pier was going to be a lot of fun.
Chapter 72. Elizabeth had explained again and again to Joyce that Farnborough wasn't an airport like Heathrow and Gatwick and that there wouldn't be shops.
but her friend is crestfallen nevertheless.
"But there's not even a W.H. Smith's," says Joyce, looking around the arrivals terminal.
"What did you want to buy, for goodness sake?" asks Elizabeth.
It is 11:30 in the morning and Frank Andrade Jr. should be walking through the arrivals doors very soon.
"Well, nothing, it's just the principle," says Joyce. "Once you've used the toilet, there's nothing else to do."
"I'm so sorry if I'm boring you, Joyce, bringing you to meet a mafia boss so we can drive him to a diamond swap where we're going to catch a murderer."
"I'm just saying," says Joyce and settles into a chair.
Elizabeth hadn't been able to persuade Ibrahim to drive them to Farnborough, so Ron's friend Mark has driven them up in his taxi. It would have been more fun with Ibrahim, but for a friend of Ron's, Mark was actually rather good company. She was worried about what radio station he would want to listen to, but it was Radio 2, so she had got off fairly lightly. Joyce is sulking. Elizabeth knows what will cheer her up.
"That really was a terrific idea, Ryan Baird as the driver. And to find him in the first place, well, that was first rate."
"Stop trying to cheer me up," says Joyce. "I should be looking at travel toiletries in Boots."
"Righto," says Elizabeth. Everything was in place. The pier would be closed for maintenance as soon as the meeting began. Chris and his team would be there. They had received a tip-off that Connie Johnson would be on the end of the pier at 3 p.m. with cocaine and a gun. A group of Japanese businessmen walk past. A driver is pushing their luggage on a trolley. Elizabeth would love to open every single bit of luggage that came into this airport. Private jets flying in from all directions. She had briefly worked as a luggage handler at Heathrow, stitching tracking devices into the suitcases of trade delegations. Sue would be there this afternoon too. That had been a tricky conversation. Yes, Elizabeth had found the diamonds. No, she didn't have them right now. Yes, they were in the hands of a South Coast drugs baron. Yes, she understood this wasn't best practice. Where had she found them? Well, that was a story for another day. On and on it had gone, threats and name-calling. I thought we had an understanding. Why did people always get so angry? We'll all be dead soon enough. Sue had calmed down eventually, and she will be tucked away somewhere watching and listening. Lance will be there too. He is staking out Martin Lomax's house, so will be driving Lomax to the meeting. That had worked out very nicely. "Can I say something?" asked Joyce.
"Not if it's about why there are no shops here, no," says Elizabeth.
"I don't want you to get annoyed with me," says Joyce. I'm just not sure that Poppy is behind all this. I know I've got a soft spot, I do know that. Ever since she trusted me with her mum's phone number, I've felt very protective of her, more fool me, perhaps.
I meant to ask, did she make eye contact when she put the number in your pocket?" asks Elizabeth. "Flutter her eyelashes, poor me."
"No, I just found it when I got back. But also, I haven't told you about the smiley face on the post-it."
"No." The arrivals doors swish open in front of them, and through them walks a man dressed for all the world as if he's heading off for a game of golf. Polo shirt, beige slacks, sunglasses pushed up into his hairline. Mid-40s, perhaps. All by himself, one small briefcase. He is looking around for the car hire desk as Elizabeth and Joyce step into stride on either side of him.
"You must be Mr. Andrade," says Elizabeth.
Andrade stops and looks at Elizabeth.
"Nope,"
he says.
"I'm Joyce," says Joyce, "and this is Elizabeth."
"I'm happy for you," says Frank Andrade. "Now, if you'll excuse me." Off he strides again, with Elizabeth keeping pace alongside and Joyce hurrying to catch up.
"You won't need a car, Mr. Andrade," says Elizabeth.
I hate to disagree, says Frank Andrade.
Mark from Robertsbridge Taxis is driving us, says Joyce. We worried the boot wouldn't be big enough for your luggage, but look at you with only the one bag. It's a Toyota Avensis.
Andrade stops again. Ladies, forgive me. I don't know who you are. I don't care who you are. I got somewhere to be and someone to see.
We know, says Elizabeth. We're here to help. You're off to see Martin Lomax.
Andrade gives Elizabeth a hard stare.
About your diamonds, says Joyce.
Andrade gives Joyce an even harder stare. Elizabeth sees Joyce blush.
For goodness sake, is there no one Joyce doesn't find attractive?
Okay, ladies, I've had a long flight. I want to get in my car. I want to visit Martin Lomax. I want to get what I came for, and I want to come straight back here and fly home.
Well, Martin Lomax doesn't have your diamonds, says Elizabeth.
I do. You got my diamonds?
I have your diamonds,
yes, says Elizabeth. Okay, says Frank Andrade. And you think I won't kill you because you're an old woman?
Oh, I'm sure you would, Frank, says Elizabeth. I don't doubt it for a moment, but equally, I would kill you without hesitation. So shall we stop the grandstanding and get down to business?
Frank Andrade laughs.
You would kill me?
She would, confirms Joyce. I don't think she will, but she would.
Okay, says Andrade. So where are my diamonds?
They're in Fairhaven, says Elizabeth, at the end of the pier.
And where is Fairhaven? Asks Andrade.
Well, you see how useful we can be to you already, says Elizabeth.
Elizabeth sees that Mark has driven around to the front of the terminal building. He gives her a quick honk on the horn. You shouldn't really honk at the Mafia, but she supposes Mark is not to know that.
You come with us, you make up with Martin Lomax, and my representative will give you the diamonds. We'll have you back here by 9 p.m. at the latest, says Elizabeth.
With my diamonds? Asks Andrade.
With your diamonds, says Elizabeth.
She points out Mark's car.
So shall we?
And why am I trusting you?
Well, just use your judgment, says Elizabeth, and look at Joyce's face. Who wouldn't trust that face?
Joyce smiles.
If you want, you can sit in the front. I was in the front on the way up, but I don't mind going in the back. I'll probably sleep anyway.
Mark is out of the car and has the boot open. He holds out his hand to Frank Andrade.
That all you got, then? I'm Mark. Nice to meet you.
Are you really from the Mafia?
Frank Andrade hands over his bag.
Yeah. He looks at the car and he looks at his three companions.
Now, says Joyce, it's at least a 2-hour drive, so do you need the toilet before we set off?
Chapter 73.
Donna and Chris are parked in a side street outside a shop selling candy floss, models of Tower Bridge, and international phone cards. They are facing the sea, grey and unhappy like the sky, and have a clear view of the entrance to Fairhaven Pier away to their left. Donna has an ice cream. She offers some to Chris, but he declines and looks down at his bag of sunflower seeds. Connie Johnson is the first to arrive. Her Range Rover pulls over onto the broad pavement in front of the pier, and she steps out and looks around her. She is carrying a large holdall, and Donna hopes it has 5 kilos of coke in it, the 5 kilos of coke that will hopefully see Connie arrested before the afternoon is through. Donna can't see the driver behind the tinted windows, but she is looking forward to re-arresting Ryan Baird too. She had to hand it to Joyce there. Suddenly, Bogdan appears, though Donna can't figure out from where. They had been watching the pier for half an hour already and hadn't caught a glimpse of the big man. The big, taciturn man with the deep blue eyes. Donna swears that her ice cream starts to melt faster. She watches him walking up the pier with Connie Johnson carrying her bag of cocaine for her like a gentleman. "He's a good guy," says Chris.
"Mm-hmm," agrees Donna.
A Black Lotus sports car pulls up next, and two men, one older and one younger, step out. Donna sees Chris look down at a picture on his phone. "That's Martin Lomax," says Chris. "The other one must be the spy?" "Lance," says Donna. Joyce had told Donna she might like Lance, but he's too old. And the hair. Not a bad try, though, Joyce. 10 years ago, maybe. Lance James and Martin Lomax begin the walk along the pier, leaving the car where it is. Donna thinks it must be nice to work for MI5 and be able to park anywhere you want. Donna had once wrestled a man wielding a sword in the Streatham Lidl, only to find her car had been clamped outside for parking across two bays. It is 3:05. People seem to be punctual where diamonds and cocaine are involved. A Toyota Avensis with Roberts Bridge taxis stenciled onto the driver's door arrives next, pulling up behind the Lotus. The driver, whom Donna doesn't recognise, steps out and makes his way to the boot. From the passenger seat steps a man who can only be Frank Andrade Jr. Martin Lomax and Frank Andrade Jr. are none of Donna and Chris's business today, but it's interesting to see them nonetheless. MI5 will be dealing with the two of them, while Kent Police deal with Connie Johnson and Ryan Baird, and no questions asked by either side. Elizabeth had brokered that deal. And speak of the devil, here she is now. Elizabeth and Joyce exit the back seats. Joyce looks like she has just woken up. The driver hands Frank Andrade a briefcase and the two men shake hands. Bogdan has returned and he motions to Frank Andrade to come with him. Andrade looks at Elizabeth, who nods. Elizabeth doesn't shake Andrade's hand and neither does Joyce, which is very unlike both of them. Bogdan gives Frank Andrade a small smile. Has Donna seen Bogdan smile before? She doesn't think so, but she would like to see it again. "Climb your next mountain," Ibrahim had told her. As she watches him walking up the pier with Frank Andrade Jr., Donna wonders what it might be like to climb Bogdan. She eats her chocolate flake whole, then starts on the cornet. "So the gang's all here," says Chris. "You ready?"
"Ready," says Donna.
She sees Elizabeth walking along the promenade now, Joyce behind her, trying to brush creases out of her skirt after the journey. They pass the Lotus and they pass the Range Rover. Joyce looks over, spots them and gives them a big wave. It will be a while before Joyce makes an effective undercover officer. Donna waves back and Joyce looks thrilled. Joyce and Elizabeth reach a nondescript white van parked by the promenade railings, cordoned off by safety tape. On the side of the van it says, "T.H. Hargreaves, railings, all jobs considered." Elizabeth steps over the tape, followed by Joyce. Someone inside the van opens the back doors and they both climb in. Chapter 74. It is a nice enough office for one man, overseeing the day-to-day running of a slot machine arcade on an award-winning pier. It is a little cramped just at the moment, however. Connie Johnson sits behind a desk with Martin Lomax opposite. Frank Andrade Jr. is perched on a windowsill. Lance James leans against a wall and Bogdan stands in front of the door.
The introductions had been swift. Mainly, who are you and none of your business. Frank Andrade Jr. had greeted Martin Lomax with a handshake, though.
Looks like I won't have to kill you today, Martin.
Looks like it, Frank.
How is your wife? Did she get the muffins I sent?
No one is quite sure how to begin. Because, of course, no one in this room has actually arranged this meeting. It has been arranged by a 76-year-old woman currently sitting in a white van 400 metres away, listening to every word they are about to say. And so it falls to the alpha character in the room to kick things off.
Okay, then, says Bogdan. We start.
Okay, then, says Bogdan. We start. Inside the white van, Sue Reardon is wearing headphones and watching the monitors relaying pictures from the cameras her team had installed in the office over the weekend. Elizabeth and Joyce are having to share headphones, one ear each. Cutbacks. You're sure she's still got the diamonds? Asks Sue.
I left Bogdan in charge of that, says Elizabeth. So, yes, I'm sure.
And what the hell's in that bag she was carrying? Asks Sue.
Elizabeth shrugs. The drugs are for Chris and Donna's benefit. Sue doesn't need to know about them. She looks back at the crowded office on her screen. The pictures are so much clearer than in her day. Frank Andrade, sitting on his windowsill, addresses Connie Johnson.
So you got my diamonds?
I've got diamonds, says Connie. I'll take your word, they're yours.
How'd you get 'em? Asks Andrade.
Fell out of my Cocoa Pops, says Connie. Are you really from the Mafia?
He's a businessman, says Martin Lomax, very well respected.
Yeah, I'm from the Mafia, says Andrade. Now show me the diamonds.
Well, here we go then, thinks Elizabeth.
They are not going to like what happens next.
Good luck, one and all.
Connie reaches into her holdall. When are they going to talk about the drugs? She wants her 50 grand and she wants to do more business with these people. She had been worried, she has to admit, about this whole thing. Cautious. But it was all going the way she'd been told. The way Vic Vincent had explained. There was a guy from the Mafia, there was some old posh guy, there always is, and there was Bogdan. All very reassuring. And she is keen to make a good impression. There's another guy, bored and balding, but he's probably just a bodyguard. Bogdan knew him, and that was enough for her. She puts the blue velvet bag down on the desk in front of her.
Well, hallelujah, says the old posh guy.
Show me, says Andrade. Pour the diamonds out on the table, don't spill any.
Don't spill any, that's a weird thing to say, thinks Connie.
But this guy's American and they say weird things. She loosens the drawstring and carefully tips the diamonds onto the table.
There you go, says Connie.
Didn't spill a thing. Both the diamonds, safe and sound.
There is a silence.
Andrade, the old posh guy, even the bodyguard are staring at the diamonds on the table. Connie senses there is suddenly an atmosphere.
You got two diamonds? Says Andrade.
Yeah, says Connie.
These are the diamonds. What were you expecting?
What were you expecting? Says Connie Johnson.
Where are the rest of the diamonds? Says Sue Reardon, looking frantically at Elizabeth.
Oh, I only gave her the two, says Elizabeth.
Just enough to flush out the killer and liven things up a bit. Any news on whether your gang have spotted Poppy lurking about yet?
Jesus Christ, says Sue. Can't you play anything straight?
Only when it suits my purposes, says Elizabeth. And it didn't suit my purposes today.
So where are the diamonds? Asks Sue.
They're safe,
says Elizabeth. They are now in Joyce's microwave because she uses it far less than her kettle. On screen, they see Frank Andrade pull a gun.
Christ almighty, says Sue. What the hell have you done, Elizabeth?
Lance sees Frank Andrade pull his gun and so pulls his own. Andrade's is pointed at Connie Johnson and Lance's is pointed at Andrade.
Where are my diamonds? Asks Frank Andrade.
All of them.
He sounds calm, but in Lance's estimation, he does not look it. Lance doesn't blame him.
What scam is being pulled here?
These are your diamonds, says Connie Johnson. Put your gun down, you drama queen.
Where are the rest?
Says Andrade. He doesn't sound calm anymore.
The rest, says Connie, this is all I was given.
Given, says Andrade, given by who?
Some old guy, Vic Vincent, says Connie. Don't you dare shoot me for this. This guy gave me the diamonds, told me this posh guy wanted 5 kilos of coke and said meet you on the pier. This is between you and him.
What coke?
Says Frank Andrade.
And who's Vic Vincent?
This coke, says Connie, reaching into her bag. But instead of pulling out cocaine, she pulls out her gun. She points it at Andrade.
This is a lot of guns in a small room, says Bogdan and sighs.
That is such an English gun, says Andrade.
What did he look like, Vic Vincent?
Old like a boxer or something,
says Connie.
Lots of tattoos, West Ham tattoos, all sorts.
Martin Lomax slams his fist on the desk.
I know him, says Lomax.
I'll bet you do, says Andrade and points his gun at Lomax.
What have you set up here?
Well, isn't that just the question, thinks Lance. Connie Johnson's gun is aimed at Andrade. Andrade's is aimed at Lomax. Lance supposes he should aim at Connie Johnson just for a sense of equilibrium. How does this play out now? It's going to end badly for someone. He just needs to ensure it's not him. What a place this would be to die. The seagulls calling overhead and the empty slot machines beeping down below. At least if he's shot, he won't have to deal with the kitchen wall at his flat. All the same, try not to get shot, Lance.
I'm as baffled as you, Frank, says Lomax.